Good afternoon, everybody. Hope you're enjoying a bit of shade out there on this beautiful afternoon. I'm Mike Ladd, and it's my huge privilege to be presenting a renowned poet, Omar Saker, to you all. Please welcome Omar straight away. We'll be having a bit of discussion and lots of poems being read. That's what you should do with a poet, I think. And Omar and I would, before we begin, would both like to acknowledge we're meeting on Kaurna land, and we pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. So Omar was born the son of Lebanese and Turkish Muslim migrants in Western Sydney, where he still lives. And as he says in his fantastic poem, Dirt, I'm part of the colony on Darug dirt, beneath Darug sky, desperate to cling to what distances me from my history, not heritage, but what begins with birth at Liverpool Hospital. Here is where my Lebanese family fled for another life. As the saying goes, out of the frying pan and into the slow cooker. That's the style of poetry you're in for this afternoon. His first book was These Wild Houses, that came out from Cordite Publishing in 2017. And that was followed by the absolutely wonderful collection, The Lost Arabs, which won the Prime Minister's Award for Poetry. His first novel, The Son of Sin, was published in 2022. And today we're focusing on his most recent poetry collection called Non-Essential Work. And Omar, that's where I want to start with. Non-essential work, I mean, it's got echoes of the pandemic, but also maybe of Plato's pushing out of the poets from his ideal republic. Why did you choose that title, Non-Essential Work?
Well, I wasn't thinking of Plato, but I, I suppose I could lie, pretend that I was. No, it was very much born of the pandemic and the language that we started to see in the public sphere around, you know, essential workers. Yeah. What is an essential worker? As a kind of protected class in one sense, but also very much not protected because they were also the front line, right? Mm. During the lockdowns. And I'm interested always in, you know, the utility or the function of art, like how much use can we extract from it?
Mm, yeah. I mean, it runs through the whole book, a sort of questioning of the utility of poetry, doesn't it? It's sort of, there's a tension there about the writing of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's
its function in society.
You know, I grew up poor in Western Sydney, so there is an element of, I guess, maybe a popular sentiment that's been conditioned into me around poetry as a kind of something effete, something elite, you know, not the province of the working class, of no use to us, really. And at the same time, I very much feel that poetry has saved my life, enabling me to articulate the things that otherwise would kill me. So that tension is a driving obsession.
Yeah, yeah. Can we hear the title poem called...
No.
No?
No, I'm joking. Of course
right.
You can.
Well, next question.
Diary of a non-essential worker. Did you know violins can shake the earth? Such sweet vessels, tiny planetary throats. I was sent an orchestra. They made music a sorrow, a soaring that shivered the dirt. I followed the notes to a barbarism. The composer said he created the beautiful hour as a space to think about war. And I heard my mother's name, a dark cascade of her. I saw again the clamor behind her manner, her harrowed glamour. I am claiming all of it now, not as a violence, but as an inevitability, always justifiable. I guess I don't want to lose her, no matter the bruises. I haven't seen her in weeks, a memory of cherries, a perishable delight. I stay home, she stays home, and with this distance we become old battlefields, able to appreciate our damages without adding to them. How lucky we are to have homes. How likely it is we will lose them. Months ago, we couldn't breathe, and smoky miracles pulverized the sky, our fussy lungs. Everything is a miracle when you are alive. I am learning that against my will. Today, I was sent a pink dwarf kingfisher, a bird thought extinct for over a century, and still, it was someone's job to look for her. Someone waited, camera in hand, for a glimpse of a glorious beak. Outside, I hear the camaraderie of ordinary wings, the chatter of birds we call pests. They don't seem to mind the lockdown. I dare say they're having fun, a lark. I call my landlord, ask for a reprieve, and hear only birdsong. He's having fun. I walk out into the park where months prior a man was stabbed near to death. I sit on the bench close to the stain his blood left and receive a text reminding me to care about Kashmir and Gaza and our Uyghur brothers and sisters who I never stopped caring about and for whom my care did nothing. Forgive me. I sometimes mistake grief for care. The orchestra follows me under the foliage, the violins unrelenting, the world shaken to their curvature, their high-strung demands, as I sift through the scattered lyric of my shattered life to find a way to love a woman, and the birds weave and whirl in the green, laughing at this non-essential work.
Fabulous. That restless tension there is right through the book, but I'd like to follow up straight away with another poem that is maybe in a more lyrical mode. It's called "I Woke Up." Can we go straight to that one?
Okay.
I woke up this morning and asked the bird if it feels trapped by its song, by its language being known only as melody. Its eloquent speech, my home is endless and dying, reduced to piping notes, a shrill ringtone. I am talking to myself. The birds are gone. This is the problem of poetry. We siren our warnings and the world drowns to the sound of our beautiful voices. I would not want it any other way. I love a good dirge, and I'm tired of being told to claim my joy. What am I to do with happiness? Where on earth can happiness reside? An astonishing number of my family are dead. An astonishing number of my family are alive. I woke up for this song.
Wonderful. There's such a lot happening in that poem. You know, there's climate change, there's sadness, there's existence, the sort of long odds of being here at all. And it's what I'd say is the lyrical mode, the first person, the lyric I. And this book is dominated by the lyric I. It's that first person I that says, come into my world and feel what I'm feeling and see what I'm seeing. And that was out for a while. You know, postmodernists sort of deconstructed the lyric I. What do you think about the lyric I?
I mean, that's a good question. I think it's... it's always a kind of impossibility. I don't think anybody can inhabit the eye. And this is what I mean when I say it's impossible, but at the same time, it's considered universal. Mm. And so I don't really care what anyone else considers in or out. I know what is of value to me, what is urgent to me, and I'm trying to express that as much as I can, as best as I can. And I don't have to worry that anyone else is going to sound like me.
Yeah, good point. I totally agree. Yeah. You speak Arabic, but you don't write it, or don't write in it, I should say.
Mm.
But I'm very interested to know what forms, like traditional forms, or if any traditional forms from the Arabic poetry world have influenced your work, and in which ways, if it has.
Mm. Yes, I speak some Arabic, and, you know, my mum and my aunties, I was raised by migrant Arab women, single Arab women, who were not educated, and as such, I'm not literate in their language, barely literate in English as well. And to this day, I'm still asked. My main role as a writer still to this day in my family is to read letters.
Mm.
The council sends them, or even their doctors send them. And I say, I'm not a doctor. And they say, well, you're the closest thing we have to understanding what the hell they're trying to tell us. So, but there is, again, a tension between what I do understand of Arabic and what I heard growing up in the Quran, which was playing all the time. So I won't say that I'm influenced by Arabic literature, classical forms in the direct sense. But, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine, a Palestinian poet, Najwan Darwish, a few years ago, and he was born and raised in Al-Quds in Jerusalem, and he's a master of Arabic in all its forms. And he told me when he read my work, he said, you have the voice of an Arab. You know, and asked me a similar question to you just now. And I said, well, I haven't read anybody. I don't know how that's possible. And he said, it's in your blood.
Hmm.
So that's all I can tell you too.
Yeah. But there are some forms in here, like the duplex. Mm-hmm. You use a form called the duplex. Could you explain what the duplex is? And that has links to Arabic traditional poetry.
The duplex is a form created by Jericho Brown, an African-American poet, which melds the sonnet with the ghazal and the blues. That's his phrasing, his way of describing it. And I do use that form quite a bit. In the book, I really love it. There is a repetition and an erosion in the repetition of those lines that for me speaks, it just really resonates because it kind of illustrates the way memory deteriorates and the kind of frisson in just reality.
Mm.
So yes, I use that form. I use others in the book, the Arabic by Marwa Halal, another invented form, an Egyptian-American poet, which is in English, but the poem is written right to left, as if it were in Arabic, and it's this kind of distortion. It makes you read the poem very differently.
Yeah. The ghazal we talked about has traditionally couplets with a refrain line on every second line. So there's some that look a bit like ghazal in this book, but they're not really. But I did feel there was something of the traditional subject matter of the ghazal in that this book has a lot to do with love, and the absence of love, the pain of losing love or looking for love. And also the identification somewhat of the poet with the bird as singer. That's another classic trope of Arabic poetry. And you've got quite a few birds, and like that one we just heard.
Yeah. I'm not thrilled about that, to be honest. I did an interview with an American poet for Poetry Magazine a few months ago, last year, in fact. And they asked me this question. They were like, you got a lot of birds in your poems. They said it was a trope of Australian poetry, actually.
Yeah.
And they're right.
Yes.
And I felt uncomfortable about that. So thank you for exposing me on the stage. I don't really have anything to say about it other than Australian birds are really loud. Really fucking loud.
But the love question. The love question.
Yeah. A lot of this book is concerned with grief and love because I wrote it after my father's death and as I fell in love with my wife. So really it's the kind of strangeness of that. You know, I met my wife, well, I knew her before, but let's say we hooked up, as I say in one poem, we hooked up 6 weeks after the funeral. And it was this kind of, I don't know, insanity. I think love is an insanity. It kind of erases reason in the same way that grief erases reason. Mm. But obviously far more joyously. And so I wanted to kind of put those two things side by side, grief and love.
Mm. Should we read that poem? I hadn't even planned to, but do you want to? The one about...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're running this show. Yeah, if you want me to, I will.
Well, please.
Okay. Don't clap till I find it. This was not on the list. When the veil parts. We hooked up 6 weeks after the funeral. That must be how long it took my departed father to beg God for his son to fall in love with a woman. I never imagined a life like this, one in which I am happy, and knowing it has ruined the future. We can only dwindle now. I try not to bother you with this foreshadowing. I watch movies. I earn small dollars. Count down the hours. Lap the block of decaying animals. Avoid the bees beginning their dizzy deliverance around helpless flowers. I do not call my mother. I laugh eerily at whatever my brother sends me. In fact, as soon as I see his name, humor wedges my spine. I fuck you on good days and bad. We argue about the dishes. I use dildos to teach myself new raptures when I am alone. This has nothing to do with your womanhood. It is mine. A long handheld heaven because I haven't met a man I trust enough to deliver me there, and this is one way we are both women. You ask me what this is about as I write it. Mandarins, I lie, and taste citrus. I don't know how to be anything other than queer and sad. I need to map a way out of this unexpected complication. And all I can think to say is ta bene. We part sometimes, and you work and sleep as I do, but these are false previews of absence predicated on return. I no longer look at mandarins except as an omen for loss. It's not all bad news. My father, God bless him, already proved that when life ends, love enters.
Mm, amazing. Yeah. This book and earlier ones, you've addressed in detail your bisexuality and at the same time your Muslim faith. And I'm wondering, how do those two sit together? What sort of challenges do you face? And how has that affected your writing?
How do they sit together? Traditionally, not that well, at least as far as my conservative family is concerned. But I will note that their sense of what is traditional is informed by gossip. And so this is something that I write about a great deal, the difference between gossip and gospel. They're not actually educated in our traditions. They're not actually educated in the Quran. And there is, in fact, a long history of bisexuality in Arabic and Islamic culture. Mm. Not something that was ever public in the way that Western queerness or sexuality is perhaps expected to be, or it was certainly more discreet, but was absolutely present. So how does it inform my work? You know, I think there is a great deal of shame that my family members and that more conservative element in the community taught me before I learned enough to know that they were stupid. and so, you know, unfortunately, though, it's not that easy to dislodge that shame, what you learn foundationally. Breaking it also breaks you. And then there is the painful work of reforming yourself or your sense of identity. And in many ways, that's what I'm doing in poetry, is each poem is a kind of fragment of self, a way home.
Mm, yeah. We should really read the poem on page 26 after that, but it should explain that it's part of a sequence throughout the book on finding the prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in Dante's Inferno. Maybe just before we read it, remind us, what is the connection between Muhammad and Dante?
Yeah. So in Dante's Inferno, late in the book, Canto 28, I think it is, Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, is depicted as burning on the eighth level of hell, just before the devil himself. And this is a canonical work, obviously. And I don't know, when I read it, I was struck by the fact that this depiction was never, you know, it's not part of the kind of popular imaginary as far as this text is concerned.
No.
And I found it quite shocking.
It's very gruesome, isn't it?
Yeah.
Everyone's being hacked and split apart.
Yeah, he's being split in half. And, you know, the actual description is like his guts and his guts spilling down to his anus or something like that. So I have a sequence in this book called On Finding the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in Dante's Inferno, and it's, you know, I use titles, I repeat titles as a way of kind of reflecting trauma, the way it repeats, the way something that happened to you years ago can suddenly overshadow something entirely unrelated.
Mm, yeah. Shall we hear that one on page 26?
On finding the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in Dante's Inferno, I slip into my insolence, sleek as an eel. I have walked so many ways around God, I can tell you holiness is a roundabout. the 1,000 exit points labeled doubt. Like the boy who unzipped my pants in my sleep, who broke the zipper of my sleep, so I have lost the measure of rest since. Like my father leaving before I knew him or could speak, my body forever unkneeling to pray, unless there's a zipper in front of me, a boy in front of me, a ghost, a beckoning, a gate where, perhaps, if I open wide enough, I will be able to wake again. And still, soaked as I am in shame, still, I care about my prophet's name.
Amazing. Two people also haunt this book. There's a father who's often associated with the word absent or absence, or a zephyr, a breeze, and who's now radically absent because he's no longer alive. And there's a mother who's has words like bruising and biting and violent words associated with it. What's the story?
The story is, like any queer man, I have a complicated relationship with my mother. And the story is also one of violence. I have written about her in all of my books. And I explain that she is a product of her environment, which was an abusive one, that she can only replicate what was done to her, and that that is the legacy of violence. How do you break that chain? Is something that concerns me greatly as I now have a child. And it's something that terrifies me, you know, the thought that I could ever cause even a fraction of the distress that I experienced growing up. So it's, you know, I love my mother. I think she's an extraordinary person to survive what the abuses that she had to survive and manage to feed us and have a roof over our heads. Despite the violences, I still am able to recognize how hard that must have been. Mm. And that whatever I have suffered, I know she has suffered more. And so it's a really difficult thing to figure out the line between accountability and forgiveness.
Mm. Yeah. And the absent father. I mean, your mother brought you up without...
Yeah, I didn't grow up with my father.
Yeah.
I met him as a young man. And even thereafter, only sporadically kind of encountered him. And then as our relationship seemed to kind of finally cohere into a almost father-son relationship, I told him that I was bisexual, and we had a very long argument about it. He was not happy, and then he died. Mm. And I was not able to resolve that conversation with him. And so in some ways, yes, he haunts me, and I think always will.
Yeah, it's in that amazing poem where you're tracing the lettering on his tomb, the gold lettering, and sort of seeking for a voice. But perhaps we should read Things That Saved My Life in this context. 84.
Okay. I like that. You're like, this is too grim. Read something positive. This is as positive as it gets, really. things that saved my life lately. Dark rye toast with peanut butter. You know the thick tang of the nut on the mouth's roof. The long lovely of close water. The deep green canal still, except where a shaggy German shepherd surges, only its head visible as it struggles toward the waiting leash. Further on, the bay, a blue feast full of leaping fish and darting birds, white boats and mirrored cloud. The water holding my worried weight. You, queer boy, you, queer joy, singing. My father submerged in the curve of my smile. The people searching for the possibility of a heartbeat beneath the buried rubble in Beirut day after day. This list, for what it's worth, contracts and expands like any heart lately small, racked with tremors. There remain the working men in high-vis vests, hot and busy constructing detours for the walkers, the women, the riders around deadly ground. My mother, traumas unresolved, and for whom, as much as love, I continue to wade through the hungry hours, snout in the air, furious in search of her hands and what together we might unknot.
There's a poem in the book called After Christchurch, which clearly refers to the Christchurch massacre. And it's a blank page. There's nothing on that page. And it's, I presume, it's a reference to Adorno. That's what I thought, that after Auschwitz, he said to write poetry would be barbaric.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Adorno quote, which he later retracted, actually. He said,
yeah,
he was wrong to say that. So, but you also do a postscript to that. Do you want to talk us through the postscript to Christchurch?
Yeah, it is a reference to Adorno. He did say that writing poetry after... the Holocaust.
Was
barbaric, but the Syrian poet Adonis responded by saying, after the atrocity, that's when you start writing poetry.
Mm.
And this is the tradition of Arabic poetry, actually, going back thousands of years into our oral traditions, where the role of the poet in society, in the village, was to lament.
Yeah.
So typically, you know, funereal.
Mm.
It was to gather and recite the story of a life. And so... Yes, I have a blank page for the massacre. And the postscript is on a different page. Mm-hmm. And I write, what did you imagine there? Write it down. I'm sick of speaking for monsters, nor will I inhabit the victims. Speak for yourselves, dear monsters. Tell us what you did. If I knew how to say it better than that, it would be in the poem, but I don't really. You know, I guess I could add just that at a certain point, it's untenable to be considered always a spokesperson for the brutalities that are inflicted on your people. It's too much. And this poem is my way of reflecting it back onto you.
Mm. Good answer. And it's often been said that if you could explain the poem better, it just would be right by writing another poem.
Yes.
That's what poets do. So I'd actually like you to read another poem called Workshop, which it references a child whose name was Alan Curdy. And I say his name because many of us didn't know that name, but many of us know the image. It's a horrible image of a drowned Syrian refugee boy, 3-year-old, on a Turkish beach, which that image has lasted in many people's minds still. And his name was Alan Curdy. And I'd like you to read the poem called Workshop, please.
Workshop borders for Ayan Kurdi and the unknown multitudes. I tell the students to write using only images. For example, a mile of sand glistens. Waves wash each grain blue. A small boy lies between the two. When I say a small boy, we all picture the same child, the one who died, the one closest to us. I fear the power of the image, how it changes nothing except myself, how it is never just an image, how the boy lives now under my bitten fingernails, how I live inside his grave, the great uncaring blue womb of the world. I have been told to be more specific. Is the blue A C, B, a chlorinated pool, C, an eye? I tell the students language paves the way to every death. Be careful with your rhetoric, especially when it feels right. We cannot be picturing the same child. We lack the imagination. We never saw him, not his life or his headline. We looked away to practice self-care. The timeline is too dark. Netflix and erasure, a deluge of icons and canned laughter and bright graphics and that ba-boom sound that lets us forget there have been many more children dead in riverbanks or swallowed by the ocean, unphotographed in the desert, blown to pieces in war zones, or caged by we, the civilized West, land of the damned free. I tell the students to move me and hope they can't hear the desperation. Teleportation is all any of us truly desire, to move and be moved in complete stillness, collapsing distances with a word, a shriven glance, an image of a poet, in this case, a man, bearded, Arab, kind of dusky, a faded, beaten sky, surrounded by students pale and dark and bored and solemn and on their phones because this is important and so not. And ugh, their rickety, peeling tables forming a square around the man, his vain efforts at peeling back the ocean, the seething black and green, the froth and heave of it, to cradle the boys and girls that never got to be so alive as to be bored by a poem, the gravid magic of rhythm given form, like La ilaha illallah, wa Muhammad Rasulullah, and doing his best, I swear his best, to be professional, to not put his head on the damp, shifting sands and beg the waves to sunder.
Mm. Amazing. Thank you. Thank you, Omar. Well, you were teaching the workshop there. But I'd be interested to know who taught you poetry? How did you come across poetry? And what are some of the poets that you love and have influenced you?
I was taught poetry by Judith Beveridge.
Good start.
Someone knows Judith. Cool. at Sydney Uni. Mm. And she was an extraordinary teacher. I was not a poet at the time. I didn't care for poetry. I thought it was crap. I thought it was useless. I took it only because I needed to fulfill... That was the last, like, unit of my degree, and I was like, all right, whatever. So this is to give you a sense of how extraordinary she is, that she took a disinterested student and was able to guide me. Just an amazing person, so generous with her time, not just in the classroom, but out of it as well. And is the kind of person who, long after the course ended, would still gather with us, the students, her former students, I should say, at Sydney Uni in an empty classroom. I don't know if that's illegal. I don't know. Like, just like off the record, off yeah. the books. And we would still just talk about poems. So I always talk about her. Mm. I have an enormous amount of love for her and her work. Poets that influenced me, Adonis, I mentioned earlier. Najwan Darwish, who I also mentioned earlier. They come up. Jericho Brown, I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's like when I'm inspired by a poet, you know, I put it in my work. I put it in my books. I don't hide it. It's not something you should ever have to go looking for. I wear my influences and I celebrate them. And, you know, June Jordan, I want to mention as well, a very important poet to me.
Yeah. And there's one about Les Murray in the book. Well, it's not about Les Murray. It's after Les Murray.
Yeah.
I was curious about that.
Not a poet who influenced me, really.
No. But...
No.
You've sort of done a version of Absolutely Ordinary Rainbow.
Yes.
His famous poem about somebody crying.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I did.
Crying in Martin Place, but you've morphed it a bit.
Yeah. You know, in that poem, there's a figure of a man crying and he becomes this kind of like Christ-like object of mourning. And it's like everyone kind of gathers around him. And it's a beautiful poem. You know, I don't want to shade Les Murray. A lot of his poems around depression, in fact, I think are really moving. So I wrote a poem where I'm crying on a train and everyone's ignoring me,
yeah.
which feels more true to the experience of grieving because people don't know how to comfort each other. Like even on an intimate level in the family or amongst friends, I feel like we don't really know how to comfort each other when we're experiencing the ravages of emotion. And we especially don't know how to deal with it when it's a stranger.
Mm.
Everyone wants to look away.
Yeah.
So I wanted to invert the meaning of that poem in mine. And yeah.
And I think we should hear it.
I knew you were going to say that. Do you know what page it's on?
That was slightly unplanned, so I haven't written that one down. I think it's...
The Importance of Planning.
Uh,
Here it is. I found it first. Blessed be this sadness after Les Murray. Ah, there are birds in this as well.
Yeah.
Why do you keep picking the bird poems? Anyway. Weeping open on the train one day, I learn no one speaks to the sorrowful except to say, I'm sorry, or I've been there, or to call like some useless bird. No one has been to this place, my sweet dark sea. You may have your own, a waterless rock, or else some other reflection of world, a bedroom, a garden of knowledge, a mouth. Mine is not a dog, not a part. Think anxious sea full of unique fish, crustaceans, and algae that wash up on a glass beach. I visit the shore every morning, afraid it will disappear without my care, my soft light. When I'm there, I hold the necklace of wounds my mother gifted me. Tiny tragedies, accidental histories, each one a jewel. Amethyst of fist, topaz abortion, and oh, the blood diamonds of neglect. Every wound here is a window back to life. Little lungs pumping air into this beautiful void. And it is beauty. Many moons of pale pink and blue hang in the sky, each one a halo. I love this grief-wrought hole. All that I have lost lives in it. Together as never in life, we swim, we school, we sink in moon and diamante sand. Bone dry, I leave wet footprints wherever I go. Back in the carriage, the necklace is heavy as a solar system and absolutely ordinary. Are you a Les Murray fan?
I am. Yes, okay. I'll be up front. I think he's a fantastic poet.
Nice.
Yeah. Okay. I have questions about his politics, but I think he did too in the end. He thought he got sucked into a lot of silly stuff and, you know, he regretted a lot of some of the stands he took. But as a poet, as a writer, I think he's one of our best. Yeah. There's a poem in here called Believe, which I'm going to read the way I read it first. It goes like this. Beliefs, sorry, lies my all put I and language in. My those are these, a lone left dog. For living worth is love, for dying worth is love. Us is world, the dying always is world. The blame to all are we. You forgive I. And I thought, well, Omar's getting pretty experimental here. And what's he up to? What are you up to?
yeah, that's an example of the Arabic form created by Marwa Halal. And if you read it in the Western way from left to right, you get that. And if you read it from right to left as you would read Arabic, it goes like this. I put all my lies, sorry, beliefs in language, and these are those my dog left alone. Love is worth living for. Love is worth dying for. The world is us. The world is always dying. We are all to blame. I forgive you.
Yeah, that one works. The body is very important in your poetry. There's a lot of, I guess, visceral, fleshy, sexual poetry here. Can you talk about the place of the body in your work?
Yeah. Sometimes I get this question around the body, and I'm always like, I live here.
Yeah. Where else would I write from?
What else would I write about? Mm. You know, even the imagination, when people talk about the imagination, as if it's this separate space, you know, that you can only access intellectually. And it's like, no, we live inside these bodies. Mm. It is always... the lens through which we experience the world. And so for it not to be centered, to be visceral, as you described it, would be to enact a kind of erasure, which I experience anyway in life. Mm. Because nobody wants to really deal with this Arab body. Or are overlaying it always with their own baggage. So it's important to me to write it the way that I experience it.
Yeah, yeah. It's just surprising how often in poetry the body isn't there. You know, it's this cerebral thing that's... and you think, where is the body of the author? But so I... It sounds like it's not a conscious project. That's just where you're writing from. That's your
natural
place.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
But also that's the question I have when I read those poems. I'm like, who's saying this? Like, where are you?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah.
You
mentioned you had a son. Back when you were writing this book, that son was still in utero. And there's a particularly wonderful poem. It's on, where is it, page 48, about your future son. Could we hear that one, please?
Mike is producing my audiobook in real time.
Once a radio man, always a radio man.
Ode to my future son. The bed is must... The sheets distressed snakes. My wife hisses within her nest. Stop kicking the blankets off. As if I control the dream. I control the dream as much as you control your mother from her womb. Not at all, and also completely. When you move within her, she gasps in delight, calling me over to feel what she feels, this future. I am too slow or late, or else you still as I near, like any deer faced with a father. He always kicks as you go, I hear. And now I know what the dream is, why I, the son of a zephyr, will never still. Even in sleep, I bound toward what recedes.
Fabulous.
Yeah. My wife loves to judge me for things I do in my sleep.
Yeah.
So that's what's going on there. I'm like, it's not my fault.
It's not my fault. How's it going now? That...
Well, I sleep in a different bed. That's how that's going. No, it's all right. I've got sleep apnea, and so I now have a sleep machine, which the baby, when he wakes up at night, loves to just reach over and... kind of yanked that off my face. And now I'm in the spare room.
Okay.
but it's going well. It's exhausting having a child, but it's also extraordinary and beautiful and wonderful and all those things that you hear. And I'm sure I will write more about it.
Yeah.
In time.
Has he appeared in any new poetry?
I'm writing a sequence at the minute documenting the experience of witnessing the genocide in Palestine. And he does feature in these poems because every day for the past 4 months, I have watched Arab children die in the most horrific circumstances, and I've seen things that I'll never be able to unsee, and each time I see my son, I see an Arab boy murdered, when I imagine that he could be or would be if not for the fact that he is here and not there.
Yeah, yes. Is there time to read No Context in a Duplex in that context? 72.
Yeah. So it's called No Context in a Duplex. I will give you the context, though, which you can find in the notes at the back of the book. The phrase tensions are escalating, which we hear all the time, out of context. And the phrase mowing the grass down, which is a phrase Israeli military has used for decades to refer to their bombardment of Gaza. It's just mowing the grass. Tensions are escalating. Mow the grass down. Stretch past pain to find poetry, the way home. Pen the past to bind home. Write even the rain. Israel, ghost nation, stains the orchards. Is rage enough to sustain a whole nation? I dream of Palestine, free, alive. Pull the line toward life. Ask the dreamer, who gave the order? Who profits from slaughter? To make a border, make a slaughter. O history, O language, burst without love. With love only, gauge the story. I said, with love. Listen, from the river to the sea, people riven from homeland list in grief. 10 sons ululating, mothers in the grass.
Amazing. I think we're going to have to finish up quite soon, but You still live in Western Sydney, but not in Auburn anymore, where I think...
No, I do live in Auburn.
Oh, you do live in Auburn. Okay, fine. Well, there's a great poem that I'd like to finish with about visiting your favourite barber in Auburn.
Yeah, okay.
I love this poem.
You didn't give me the number, did you?
It is 88.
88. Oh, man. If any of you follow me on Twitter, you will see that I was mentioning this poem because I saw this barber yesterday. I hadn't seen him in a couple of years. I bought a ring off of him, a turquoise ring, a couple of years ago, and I lost it at Adelaide Airport yesterday.
Oh, no.
So I'm very upset about that. But I hadn't seen him in years, and I just think it's nuts that I've... Because his shop shut down in the lockdown, and I went to a different barber, different place in Auburn yesterday, and there he was. And then I lost his fucking ring. Returning to Auburn, I remember. I am happiest with the blade at my throat, a man in my ear. The barber was born in Iraq, and around him are thousands of evil eyes, blue to ward off evil eyes. Hundreds of prayer beads dangle down from brown to black, jade to jewel, waiting for a hand to wield them, to utter God's names and keep worry at bay. Hassan heaps my hairs, and from the back room, the chirp of birds, the hymn of wings suffuses the shop. He would never keep a cat or a dog, he said. His birds need to be fed and watered and loved at least 3 to 6 times a day. Providing these ingredients keeps him occupied. A tap seeds conversation. The birds thrash at their cages, hooting and trilling and arguing about the definition of a sky. One says above, the others say a lie, say view, say inside. Nearby, the mosque that briefly held my father in a metal casket, the masjid in which I mourn him, readies itself again for my regrets. I do not live here, but I return to Hassan's hands, his trapped birds, to be shorn of my beard, to feel the boy inside, the night-gazing, star-slumming cloud-shaper thrash in the back room for a drop, a seed, love.
Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you so much, Omar. And please, yeah, give extra round of applause for Omar. That's a fabulous poetry reading.